Comments made on Sarah's perspectives are those of the individuals and do not represent Sarotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Good evening, morning, or afternoon, depending on where you may happen to be. This is Steve Sawson, and this is This Month in Tech on Sarah's perspectives for August 2012. Thanks for joining me and for putting up with my attempt to read the disclaimer, the easy part of this. We've got a panel of folks with us this evening and, of course, a number of topics as we attempt to cover this month in tech. And I'm going to go ahead and get right to it. We'll introduce our panels. If you are in the chat room, feel free to chat with us. We have Lisa, who is monitoring the chats and who may jump in from time to time. And we have Joe in the wings here, controlling the web content, making sure that what we talk about is displayed on your screens and available accessibly through Accessibly Event. And of course, is available in the show notes after the fact. About our guests, we are joined by Rich Cavallaro, who is a computer information technology major at Hofstra University. He is graduating in December 2012, and this is exciting because I remember a couple years ago when Rich was starting at the university. Technology has been a passion of his since a very young age. He's been an instructor for the Technologically Empowered College Students, TECHS, program in New York, and does a lot of stuff with them, and he can talk about that in just a minute. And he also is on the Hofstra radio station. Is it RHU? Radio Hofstra University, I believe. I'm just sort of briefly going through the bio, but thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
And of course, we have contact information for all our guests in the show notes as well. Luke Leiby, whose name I've probably just messed up, is from New Cumberland, Pennsylvania. Luke is 15 years old and is in 10th grade. He's interested in music, especially recording, production, and engineering. Fascinated also with technology and recognizes that it develops quickly day by day, and he likes to keep up with the latest and newest and see what technology the visually impaired can use. Luke, thanks for joining us this evening. Do we have Luke? Do we have anyone?
You have me. I'm still here.
You're still here. Well, let's go ahead and introduce you then. And I'm not sure what just happened. Esten Talavera is the assistive technology specialist for the Envision Rehabilitation Center. And of course, we have their URL. He assists patients with assistive technology. He's also one of the instructors for the annual Envision Assistive Technology Camp for middle school and high school students with vision impairments, and a podcaster for the YouTube Assistive Technology Podcast Tips and Tricks. He is seeking a degree from Wichita State University. And Esten, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's a great joy to be here.
Well, great. Well, it's a pleasure to have everyone. And as you may have guessed by some of the bios, the panel is far younger than me. And I hate to say that, but it's true. I am getting older. And as such, it's good to have these young folks with us. Did I really just say that? Anyway, I think it is interesting, to me at least, to see how perspectives have changed. And so before we get into this month's various topics, what I'd like to do is sort of pull the group and find out what technologies can you just not live without? And to those of you who are more advanced in age, shall I say, I think this will be interesting to listen, and perhaps you might reflect on what technologies you may have not been able to live without when you were back in the school days, as it were. Rich, we'll go ahead and start with you. What technologies can you not live without or not imagine living without?
I would say, for me, my iPhone is one of the technologies that I use every day. It's just so useful, and I could just do so many things with one device in my pocket. I use it for email, for social networking, for music, for reading books, listening to podcasts. The list goes on and on. And that's really probably the one piece of technology that I would say I use every day that I can't live without. With
so the iPhone, the piece of technology that for many years people speculated would never be accessible for the to the blind because it's just touchscreen based. That's the technology you can't live without.
Definitely.
Well, very, very good, Luke. I'm not sure if you're back with us or if we're still having audio issues, but if you are there you are. I think. What technology can you not imagine living without?
Well, thank you. I apologize for not being able to introduce myself when you gave the introduction as well. And I will apologize in advance for not being able to have clear audio. But I have to say the technology that I use daily would have to be a little netbook that I have from Acer. I use that daily, on a daily basis. I use it for schoolwork, homework, and I also use it for some of my music production. If I hadn't had that, I probably wouldn't have made it to 10th grade.
Well, that's fantastic. A netbook. I remember my first laptop. It was a Toshiba T1200. Had a 20 megabyte hard drive, 640K of RAM. Weighed about 10 pounds, at least. And had a battery life of, I don't know, 10 minutes, or at least it seemed. We've sure come a long way. Welcome. And Eston, the piece of technology you cannot imagine living without.
You know, it would have to be a combination of my iPhone and my MacBook Air. I use my iPhone pretty much every day, and I use my MacBook Air that I recently received as well pretty much every day for music, for listening to music, getting email, doing all that kind of stuff. And the one piece of technology that's really helped me through school would have to be the Apex, the Braille Note from Humanware. I don't use it nearly as much as I used to use it, but because of the iPhone, and I'm able to pretty much keep the phone with me at all times and not have to worry about so much with the Apex and the being able to use the laptop. So that would probably be the pieces of technology that are most important for me.
Well, very awesome. And if you are in the chat room, perhaps you could let us know what piece of technology you can't imagine living without, or maybe couldn't imagine living without if you've been out of school for, shall we say, a few years like I have. And maybe Lisa can break in here and let us know as those messages come in, and we can put that into the podcast here and kind of get some comparisons and perspective. How to upgrade your Hotmail email address to Outlook.com. Outlook.com is the new Microsoft Hotmail web-based service thing that is actually kind of exciting. I have not used this myself. The page should be appearing shortly here for you, if not already, but there are instructions about what you need to do to upgrade. And I don't know if this shows it, but there have been a couple of different blog posts throughout the web discussing the accessibility of Microsoft's Outlook.com, which is, like I say, they're basically it's Hotmail improved and rebranded. Any thoughts on Outlook? Anyone using Outlook.com, or has anyone gone through the upgrade process from Hotmail?
I have not, but I have seen this article, and honestly, I use Gmail, so this is not really my mail provider of choice, but I think it's great that that's certainly an option out there for people to use.
I have 5 email accounts as of right now for work and for home use, and I would like to see the accessibility of this before I get into it, because through the AT program, we give the students Gmail accounts, but if we were able to find a different account provider like Hotmail, then we might use that instead. So I'd be interested to see the accessibility of this, but for my personal use, I don't think I would probably use it.
You know, it's interesting. Rich mentioned using Gmail, and I think a lot of people who were originally Hotmail users switched to Gmail early on because Gmail offered a lot more space. I don't remember exact numbers, but it was considerably more space than that offered by Hotmail at the time, and also for free. And so there was a huge sort of migration of people over to Gmail, and it'll be interesting to see now that Outlook.com has sort of improved mail storage and other functionalities to see if people start coming back because it, of course, is integrated with the other Microsoft services, or, you know, how that goes. My understanding is there is quite a lot of keyboard functionality now in Outlook.com. I haven't used it, so can't confirm that, but I've seen reference to a number of keyboard shortcuts and so forth embedded in the new service, so that, of course, is very exciting. Windows 7 is about to surpass Windows XP as the leading OS. This, I never thought would happen, but apparently it's gotten enough installs, enough people are using it now, that it's about to surpass Windows XP, which of course has been around since 2002, I believe. Any thoughts on that? What are people thinking about Windows 7? Let's start with Luke, you're using a netbook, and is your netbook Windows 7 or is it some other OS?
Currently, I am using Vista as my OS. I'm using my bigger laptop. It's more of an older model. It's a Sony. It came out when it was around Vista, but I also do have a netbook, which I use for school purposes, the bigger one I use for just personal music, iTunes, everything like that, that, you know, I don't really need to have taking up the memory on my netbook. However, I obviously work with Windows 7 on a daily basis, and I would have to say that Windows 7 is second to best, or the absolute best, for accessibility with the interfaces of the menus. I haven't had any problems with it, and I'd say it would have to have more of a variety of interfaces and more customizability, if you want to put it like that, customize it to a certain degree that possibly Windows XP was not able to do.
It is very exciting. I think it surpassed a lot of people's expectations. I'm a Mac user, so granted, I'm a bit biased here, but when I watched the unveiling of Windows 7, the launch, I was very impressed. I thought, wow, this is neat. I was not impressed at all with Vista, but when Microsoft released Windows 7, I thought, this is going to be a serious contender, and for once, I was right, so that's exciting to me. It is neat. A lot of people are kind of nervous about the interface, but it does seem to be very easy to get used to. Any other thoughts on Windows 7 and it becoming the dominant operating system?
I think also applications are to come into play here, being that Microsoft Office 2013 won't support XP, that IE9 and above won't support XP, that it's a sign that really Microsoft wants to push Windows 7 to their user base. And also the start search box in Windows 7 is great. The ability to adjust individual applications volume controls are two things that I like. So I really think that we're going to see XP, especially also since that support is soon ending for that operating system, we're going to really see 7 continue to take off in leaps and bounds. And of course, Windows 8 is coming out very soon as well.
I've talked to customers and to private students that I work with, and it seems like there are two groups of people. There are the early adopters, and they have had 7 almost since it came out, or then there are kind of the hesitant people, and they either got Windows 7 because their old machine blew up and they had no choice, or they're now feeling that they have no choice as support for XP is going away. And most of the people that I've spoken to, after the first couple days of feeling like a deer caught in the headlights, they really like Windows 7 very much. I think the main grievance for most people who've switched to Windows 7, and one of the main reasons, besides the familiarity that keep people staying with XP, is the fact that Windows 7 does not contain a dedicated email client. And there is Windows Live Mail, but that is always changing and does not seem to be terribly stable. So, as was mentioned, people seem to love the start menu, the search box. I know I do myself. I use it all the time. And I've talked to people who, once they got Windows 7, you know, couldn't really figure out why they had waited so long. So I was really glad to see this particular article.
It's very exciting. I'm very impressed with it. The thing that confuses me, and I guess it's just me, because whenever I mention this, people are like, really? You find this confusing? Is the save as dialog, or the open file dialog box that lets you browse to a different folder. I get tripped up on that every single time, and it's probably just me and not being used to the layout, getting older, I guess, but it is really neat, and as frustrating as I get with the save as and open dialogues, or file logs, as I'm calling them, the search box more than makes up for it. The fact that I can just type in something and have it find it, and I don't have to look to see where I saved it or where the application is. So very exciting stuff. It's neat to see that it is successful, and especially with there being a lot of sort of questions around Windows 8, it'll be interesting good to know that we have an option out there that's stable and that's not going away anytime soon.
I think that Windows 7 is going to be very much like Windows XP in that it's probably going to stay around for a long time. We don't know that for sure, but with Windows 8, it seems to be a lot more of a very big change And so I think that we'll see Windows 7 sticking around for a while.
I agree. I think you're right. I think businesses are starting to use it now too, and they tend to be slow adopters of new operating systems because, you know, needing to ensure that data is safe and that sort of thing. And so once they switch, they're not going to want to switch again right off the bat. So I think you're right. I think Windows 7 is going to be around for a while, and that's good news.
I also wanted to say about Windows 8, the significant difference that I'm aware of between Windows 8 and Windows 7 is the interface of it for the user. As far as I'm concerned, I have a friend who's downloaded the demo version, puts it as a mobile phone type of interface. So, of course, that would not be very much accessible to the visually impaired and the blind as far as screen readers go. It's also probably not going to be likely used in a lot of businesses until they change the interface, until it's more of a computer-based interface such as Windows 7 or XP. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I tend to agree with you, but I remember that same argument being made way back in the days when Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 came out, and people saying, you know, business users aren't going to use this because it's less efficient, you're not doing stuff from the keyboard, takes longer to load word processing applications and things like that, you know, really don't need the multitasking capabilities. And of course, that's old news, very old news at this point. It happened. I don't know. I mean, I hear the counter argument too that, you know, now people will be able to have their desktop operating system and their mobile operating system be the same. And so for business users, you could, you know, work at your desk and then take your tablet home and continue working, or go to a meeting with your tablet and have everything kind of be the same interface. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out, and maybe coming back in a couple of years and listen to this episode and see how things have changed. It'll be exciting. On the next topic, we have a Serotech special for Mountain Lion. That's what it says here, and the URL is coming up. And Lisa, do you want to talk about this?
Basically, we had a number of guests with us, including our guest presenter. We welcomed back Michael Loff, and he presented with an excellent panel, and they talked about what is new in Mountain Lion, which is the latest operating system for Mac. And they talked accessibility and usability and the install experience. And so if you did not hear that and you are interested, I would encourage you to get the download and listen. And, you know, maybe you're a Mac user and maybe you're not. Maybe you're a Windows user. You might find it interesting to listen to this anyway so that you can learn kind of a bird's eye view and overall glance kind of at what is available, because there are times when Apple follows Windows and Windows follows Apple, or they do their own thing. But it's an interesting way of seeing what kinds of trends could conceivably be coming for your iOS, not quite your operating system. So I would encourage you to take a listen to that, and it's definitely a quality piece of work that was done by our presenters, and we are very happy to be able to bring it to you.
Well, that's fantastic. And Mountain Lion, of course, is also very successful. People are liking it. Even as a Mac person, I admit I dragged my feet a little bit with Mountain Lion. I wasn't so sure I wanted to do it, and I'm very glad I did. It admittedly took a bit of peer pressure from other people saying, hey, you're going to love it. You got to do it. But it is a very exciting operating system. There's a lot of interesting functionality in it. A lot of things that have existed in iOS are now similar to Mountain Lion. And I think it's kind of interesting because as we hear more and more about Windows 8 and the Microsoft tablet and some of those things, we also see sort of a unification of desktop/mobile operating systems. And that's sort of what's going on with Mountain Lion and iOS. So give it Absolutely. A listen. Sounds like a great panel. I will also give it a listen. I'm copying the link right now here, and tomorrow while I'm at work, I will tune in.
I agree with Ricky, though, when she mentioned on Serotalk podcast that, you know, these names are so over the top. She voted for, like, West, you know, Tabby, or can't remember all the names that she used, but these, like, nice domestic cat kitten sort of names. So we had some fun with that, and If you want to hear more about Mountain Lion or about basically prognostications about what's coming next in any of the operating systems, I do encourage you to check out other podcasts. We have Serotalk. I'm not going to name them all because I'm going to miss some. It's just the law. But of particular interest, if you are tech-minded, you should definitely consider checking out Serotalk and Triple Click Home and also That Android Show.
All fantastic podcasts, all in my Downcast player. If you're an iOS user, there's a couple of different podcasting apps out there now, but Downcast is one that I particularly like, and it works great. And so,
yes,
yeah, you may want to check that out. It's made my commute certainly more enjoyable, and sometimes I'm even listening at work. I don't think I'm supposed to, but that's okay. And speaking of work and people that may never have to work again, there was a landmark or landslide case here. Was it last week that there's been sort of an ongoing feud between Apple and Samsung over a patent dispute, and the jury found for Apple and awarded them $1 billion from Samsung. So $1 billion, a nice little settlement for Apple. If they need help investing any of those winnings, they can certainly reach me, and I'll buy everyone Downcast. Anyway, Apple won $1 billion, a huge, huge lawsuit, huge settlement, and there is a frequently asked questions about this and what it all means. The patents had to do with touchscreen technology, and it's just amazing. It's just a huge $1 billion. I kind of want Samsung to pay it in pennies just to see kind of how big that is. Either way, though, any thoughts on the Apple-Samsung lawsuit / settlement?
I think it's interesting that the jury came out in 3 days. I mean, that seemed to be a very big thing, that they kind of had one day where they were trying to argue whether or not Samsung really copied Apple or not, but and then they used the other 2 days to fill out the however long page document that was given to them. I mean, I think that was a very quick decision, and I think it'll be interesting to see if it's held up. I'm sure it probably will be. We'll see. But I think that there is definitely some impact. We may see more expensive phones from Samsung because they may end up paying Apple. But there is also rumors that Apple and Google were trying to settle and talk to each other. So we may see that happen too. We may see Apple and Google settle with license fees or how that kind of thing. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
It certainly will. I was surprised at the dollar amount. I guess I'm hung up on that, but what an amazing, staggering figure. I'm glad I'm not an attorney working for Samsung. I can't imagine what they must have felt. Any other thoughts on this lawsuit, which alleged that Samsung copied Apple on some of their touchscreen stuff?
Comments in the text chat. It's really funny because I read enough of these stories that I think, oh, okay, let's just, you know, take our toys and go home, and my eyes kind of glaze over after a while. But we've gotten a bunch of comments. You know, that one was that everybody's out to make a fast buck on this kind of issue, that the lawsuits in general about patents are pointless. Somebody else was asking if money was really even the issue, or was it more the principle of the thing? You know, it does bring up interesting questions about, at least in my mind, about what is patentable and what is not. And from an accessibility standpoint, you know, are some of these accessible ways of doing things patentable, thus shutting out others who could, you know, use similar things in their devices?
I think that's definitely a very good possibility. We're seeing an impact of that now because a lot of Samsung phones were updated to take away some of those features that the patents had talked about. And we saw that happen already. So I think that that's a definite possibility. And Samsung has already said that if Apple comes out with an LTE iPhone, that they're going to basically sue them as soon as they possibly can, which in the court systems means probably we'll see a suit in October or November. So we'll see what happens with that too.
Very interesting stuff. And yeah, I don't I guess money is always an issue. It's just hard to really imagine it, given how wealthy these companies are, that, you know, $1 billion is certainly no pocket change, but it is just amazing to think that the financial impact isn't as great, potentially, as the impact of what you said, you know, what can be, you know, considered patentable and whatnot, and some of those other sort of behind the scenes yet very large issues, and to see how that sort of ripple effect will affect other areas of technology, or especially assistive technology, but technology in general in terms of what's patentable and what's not. There are 5 reasons that the Samsung-Apple ruling is good for everyone, and we have a page about that as well that we'll put up here in just a second. The iPhone 5 is something we keep hearing about. We don't know if it'll have LTE and hence will be the possible cause of yet another lawsuit, but either way, it's rumored to be coming very, very soon. And the rumor is because it has rumor until it's official, but, you know, officially released. But because of its bigger screen, it's going to have a 5th row of buttons. Right now, the iPhone has 4 rows of buttons. And it's because it's going to have a larger screen, it's going to have a 5th row. So more applications on each screen.
I think that's going to be great, because you can store more applications, you know, on your screens, and you can add more folders. And I'm really excited for iPhone 5. I think that it's going to offer a lot of great enhancements, I have a feeling, as far as, of course, with iOS 6. And something tells me that there's going to be something that maybe even the rumor sites haven't picked up. I know, that, of course, the screen's larger and thinner device. So I'm very curious as to what is the next big thing to really differentiate this and what Apple has done before. I look forward to these iPhone upgrades, because they always tend to do something that's really revolutionary, I think.
I'm ready for the upgrade.
So you're excited about it and likely going to get it then?
Absolutely.
What would convince you one way or the other, do you think, Rich?
I think, I'm an iPhone 4 user, so I'm eligible for an upgrade anyway. And I think that provided the hardware and software combination really had something that was really revolutionary, I would upgrade. If it, I think, was just, say, a little faster and a better camera, then I would probably stick with what I had. But I have this feeling that something big is coming.
I have a 4S myself, and I'm considering upgrading. One reason is that I'm on AT&T, and I'm considering switching to Verizon. Another reason is that I just think that a bigger phone will be better, but then that Apple is going to come out with something that we'll see. I'm really excited for the supposed turn-by-turn navigation. I think that's going to be really nice, especially for people who rely on transportation, who are on buses or in cars, who sometimes give instructions to people on how to get some places. I think that that's going to be exciting for them. I think that we'll see a lot more. But the 5th row of buttons is not something that I'm really like super excited about. I think that Apple's going to have something else that's going to be major. I think the 5th row of buttons is just something that was we made the screen bigger, so I guess we can add another row of buttons, so let's just do that.
And I'm curious, what do you all think about the rumor of the dock connector changing? Why do you think Apple is doing that?
Well, we've had the 30-pin dock connector for a while. I don't know how long, but we've had that 30-pin dock connector for a while, and they're rumored to go to a 9-pin, I think.
That's what I heard as well.
Okay. So they're rumored to go to a 9-pin adapter, so that'll be a little bit smaller. So I think that Apple is just thinking that since we have the ability to make this connection a little bit smaller, and then we can add a little bit to our battery because LTE is probably going to be a drain on the battery, a big drain on the battery. And so it's like, well, we can keep the connector the same, and we can not have a bigger battery, or we can make the connector a little smaller, make people buy a ton more gadgets, because now every gadget that you have has to be converted or made new. You have to buy them again. And so it's kind of a win-win for Apple, at least. And so that may not be the reason. I'm betting that they'll say something about it on September 12th, and so next Wednesday.
And there's also rumor that they'll be selling an adapter for the, I don't know what price point, but for those of us that have gadgets that use the existing dock connector. You'll be able to get an adapter to use with Apple's rumored new dock port. And I don't know what the price will be on that. Lisa?
These were only rumors, but what I heard, if I remember correctly, is that the price of the adapter will be around $9, and the price for a cable will be $18. I have kind of a different view about why Apple went with the smaller dock, and it also goes along with why they... Another rumor that I heard was that they are putting the headphone jack on the bottom of the iPhone, which I'm not really a fan of myself. I like it where it is. Although I've heard that the earbuds are being redesigned and they should be nicer. But my feeling is, you know, Apple really rode quite the wave of success when they came out with the iPhone 4S and it had Siri. From what I've seen so far of the new iOS and from what I've heard about the rumors, the new iPhone just does not have any one thing that is spectacular enough to rival Siri. So my guess is that they are making hardware changes just to give this phone something different, to make people think, oh, this is newer, this is better. I really think where the iPhone 4S was all about hardware, really the power in the next iPhone 5 will be, I think, more related to software and to the new operating system. But of course, this is all speculation, and as was said, we'll have to wait until the 12th or after to really see.
I think Apple is the only company that we talk about the speculation of rumors about rumors of rumored things that haven't come out yet that we don't really know if they're going to come out. And I just really think that's kind of amusing that we're all wondering what's it going to be, but it's great. It's great marketing for Apple.
I think they absolutely love that hype. I mean, you're right. Every time there's any Apple event, there's all sorts of rumors about, you know, we're going to see the new iPad, we're going to see the new iPhone, they're going to re-release this, and then the event happens, and they might do one of those things, they may do none of those things, and yet, even if they do none of them, it doesn't stop people from speculating at the next Apple event about what is going to be coming and what's going to be released and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, the one thing that interests me is just the analyst predictions of how many units they're going to sell. I mean, they're claiming this is going to be the best thing since the original iPhone in terms of sales. And there's quite a few people saying this, and yet unofficially, when I talk to people or read my Twitter feeds and whatever, there are obviously people who are interested in this new iPhone, but there's a lot of people who are concerned about, you know, geez, is it going to work with my existing hardware, my speaker dock or whatever? I'll have to get a new case, and I've had this case already, and I spent a lot of money on it, and that sort of stuff. So people kind of frustrated that the hardware will force them to buy new accessories again, and they haven't had to do that since the 4. Will these people go out and buy the 5? I don't know. The analysts seem to think, yes, it's a no-brainer. They're going to run for it. There's also the people like myself that upgraded to the 4S and may not have the ability under contract to get the 5 because we still have another year remaining on the contract. So it'll be interesting to see how many people like me jumped to the 4S and now are sort of stuck and have to wait agonizingly for a year or so before they can get the 5.
You know, I'm in the situation where I have an iPhone 4, and I heard a couple comments, and someone just said this in the text chat area, that she would probably get the iPhone 4S. And depending on what the new iPhone offers, I've thought of that too, because I would get a faster processor, but I wouldn't get the funky new dock. I wouldn't have to make those changes yet. But really, I don't know quite what I will do. It will come down to what exactly is truth and what exactly is rumor with these new iPhones. My thing, too, I don't really want... And now, I know it wouldn't be much larger and it would be thinner, but I don't want a much larger phone. I feel like this is just a nice size, and anything much bigger isn't a phone, it's a small tablet.
What do people think about the headphone jack on the bottom? There was kind of an interesting Twitter discussion last night, at least on my timeline, about the pros and cons of a bottom-facing headphone jack and what that could mean.
I like where currently is personally. I don't really think that's such a great tweak of the design, but I guess they had their reason for it. Or if it even did, even if that does come, of course, that is, I think, a rumor at this point, or has that been proven to be coming?
Well, it's all speculation. There's a lot of things pointing to it, but, you know, there was all kinds of drawings of the new iPad, and it was going to have all kinds of features, too, and then it was released, and so it's really hard to say until it actually happens. But there is a lot of speculation that says if they go with the smaller dock connector, then they will also have the bottom-facing headphone jack, and that if you put it in your pocket, you are likely to put it in upside down anyway if you have it in your hand. I don't know if that's true. I've never really, I guess I've always done it the right way that I don't think about it now, but I guess, I don't know. It'll be an interesting design shift if they in fact do that.
I have an iPod 4th generation that I've had for about 2 years now. I got it back in 2010. And of course, with the, I can't remember if the original model of iPods or iPhones had the bottom-sided headphone jack, but I personally prefer it that way, only because, say, if you're in an environment such as a car or something, and the way you hold it is facing, of course, with the headphone jack on the bottom part of the iPod or iPhone, whatever the case, whatever device you have, anything that starts with an I. I found it much more easier because the cord didn't seem to get in the way of anything else or didn't get anybody else's personal space. I could have it tightly in my own space on, you know, my right side if, you know, you keep it on your right side, whatever the case is, but it stays within your personal space. It also does not, if you have it on a desk, say if you're at work or anything, or if you're in class, for example, and the teacher allows you to listen to music or whatever the case is that you need your phone for, and you need headphones, if you're like some of these kids today who just care for listening to their iPods while they listen or while they do their work, they're most likely going to have headphones in. And if they do have the iPhone 4S, I believe, that's the latest iPhone that I've actually had the chance to work with a few days before giving my opinion for it to a couple other visually impaired people. Perhaps if a kid is in that environment and there's a student walking by their desk and the cord happens to be hanging out on the left side of the desk because the headphone jack is on the top of the iPhone, that would be liable to either have the student break their phone because they walked by and they accidentally, accidentally brushed by that cord. That cord is not strong enough to hold it in an iPhone that's about 10 times its own weight. But in the case that you do have an iPod that has the bottom headphone jack, you're less than likely to run into that situation.
That's true. That's definitely very true. And actually, when I think about it, at work on my desk, I have two cables, one which is the charger cable that plugs into the bottom of the iPhone, and then I have another one that is the, I have a splitter that connects my iPhone and my computer to my headset. So I have a cable that plugs into the top, but because of the way my desk is situated, that top cable has to sort of go under and around my phone. And, you know, it would be kind of easier if they were both in the same place. Then I could even tie the two cables together, potentially, and have both ends kind of coming to the iPhone at the same location. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that actually does come to fruition and what, again, what that means for cases. I guess the size is going to be different anyway, so cases are going to have to be redesigned. But for people that have these OtterBox cases and some of these other expensive cases that are very form-fitting, you'll have to get new ones. So it'll be interesting to see what that all means. By the way, if you are an AT&T subscriber and want to know if you are eligible for an upgrade, you of course can call AT&T. If you want to avoid doing that, you can also dial *639#, which is *new*639#, and hit send. Do that as if you're making a phone call, and it will text you back and let you know if you are eligible for an upgrade. Now, I remember last year, AT&T changed the eligibility requirements right before launch. They had a thing where if you had a year and you were going to extend for another two and you were willing to pay a fee, certain customers were allowed
to...
Are they doing that again?
Yeah. If you Yeah, if you have an iPhone, and I bought my 4S in October when it was released, and it is now probably September, and if I pay $250 plus the price of the phone, which we'll assume about $299, I can get the phone on AT&T's network. So they are doing that again for some customers. I don't know if all of the all customers are getting that, but I know that at least I am.
Well, Star. So,
I know for me, I've been eligible for an upgrade since June, and I bet AT&T will want their customers to take advantage of the latest and greatest hardware. So I have a feeling they'll probably do something similar to what they did with the 4S to get customers to be able to get the latest and greatest hardware and to sign another tier contract to keep more customers.
I mean, that's how I did it. I think it cost me $36 plus the $199 or whatever the cost of the 4S was, because I had just gotten the 4, and then, you know, a year later the 4S, so I had to go for another 2 years plus $36 plus the cost of the phone, the $199 under contract. I think that's what it was. And that's how I was able to get the 4S. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. If they do that again, I may have to get this 5. I think my wife has already sort of accepted that I'm probably going to get, as she puts it, yet another gadget. So we'll see what happens. Anyone else, Eston or Luke, thinking about the iPhone 5? Or
maybe you can always gazelle your 4S. I'm doing that. I'm gazelling it, and I'm going to get $277 back for gazelling it, and then that will go toward buying the new iPhone and getting me off of the AT&T contract, or paying for the early upgrade for the AT&T contract. I'm definitely considering getting the iPhone 5. I think I probably will as soon as pre-orders are coming out. Whenever that happens to be, I'm definitely considering it.
Going back to the development of a 4S, the way I would approach getting the new iPhone 5, of course there is, like I believe someone said earlier, that analysts predict that a lot of people will be upgrading their iPhone 4S or iPhone 4 to the iPhone 5. And I don't know if any of you who have had the 4S have experienced any server issues with particularly Verizon last year, I believe. I dealt with a friend of mine who is visually impaired and has who had the 4S when it just came out. So, you know, he's one of those people that has the coolest gadgets and the newest technology, whatever it is, he'll have it. And he had an iPhone 4S, and after a while, and whatever he did, like a, some kind of gesture, a slide to the right with one of his fingers, a voiceover would take a while to respond to that gesture. So he had a lot of issues with that. Another thing is that the phone seemed to lock up, especially when he was trying to receive a call. And as I can remember, if he hooked it up to his computer, the phone would have a lot of issues syncing to iTunes and everything else. He called Verizon, and he said that many people on the network of Verizon that it crashed. Taking that in mind, I'd rather not go through the headache of dealing with all that myself. And plus, a lot of people are looking to get money for a new phone, which is why they'd be selling their old models. For example, once the iPhone 5 comes out, now taking I'm 15 and I don't have a job, I would consider getting the 4S before the 5, just so that I know that I have something that will work, most definitely something that will work, before switching to the 5.
Well, I think that's very smart. I really do, because I remember everyone jumping to the 4 when it came out, and then everyone crying about the antenna issue. There was the infamous 4 antenna issue, where if you held it by the sides, the reception quality would degrade significantly. And then there was a bumper thing that Apple was giving out that you could put around your phone. But if you didn't get it, then you had to buy it, or else use a case. Or I read this one article, and I thought this was really cool. You could duct tape it. You could use duct tape around it and do that. I thought that'd be the ultimate in style. But anyway, the point being, you can be an early adopter and pay for being an early adopter, sometimes in ways that are not expected. So I think that makes sense, and you're right. There's going to be a ton of people selling their 4Ss, and if you can deal with a piece of technology that literally is a year old, you know, you can probably pick one up pretty inexpensively, just like those people that didn't jump to the 4. Once the 4S's came out, they could easily jump from the 3GS to the 4 with very little impact. I think it's a very good approach. So once you get that job I guess the thing to do is sue Samsung, then you could maybe get a billion. Then you can go ahead and do it that way and probably be further ahead. What the iPhone 5 is rumored not to have, and I'm a bit sad about this, is what's called NFC, near field communication. And what NFC is, in a nutshell, it's a technology that allows devices that are in close proximity to each other to sort of sense each other's presence and perhaps transfer data. So I guess in a real world example, you might have a speaker and you tap your phone on the speaker and then the output of the phone will go through that speaker. Or Sprint has a couple of phones that you could go to certain stores, Google Wallet enabled stores, and you basically tap your phone on the cash register or some sensor on the cash register, and then it will essentially pay for your purchase using your phone. So it's a technology that, you know, you can't use it from across the room. You have to usually tap something or be within a few inches of something to make it work. But it has staggering applications in terms of, you know, pairing with speakers, unlocking doors, paying for things. Who knows where it might head, starting vehicles. I mean, there's lots of possibilities with NFC. A lot of Android devices already support it, and it was hoped by many that the iPhone would also support it, just because this is a technology that seems to be evolving pretty quickly in a number of areas. And unfortunately, articles show that it will not be supported, or is likely not to be supported, in the iPhone 5. We are experiencing some difficulty with displaying content, so if you're in the chat and are wondering why the pages aren't showing up, we know that they're not, and we apologize for that. They will be in the show notes, but we are experiencing technical difficulties. Let's see, not likely to support NFC. There is also an app that we have that, this is, I think, the last iPhone thing, folks, so bear with me. There's an app, though, that will allow it to read your heart rate simply by letting it stare at your face. And that is fascinating.
That definitely, you know, there's really is another, fascinating. That app really is fascinating. I've not tried it, but I read the article. I was like, wow, it's amazing what ideas these developers come up with and how accurate, according to when this app was tried out by the reviewer, how accurately it did seem to work.
I had an incurable case of nose trouble, so I plunked down my $4.95 or whatever it was, and I wasn't sure it was going to work, because at one point it said something about hold the phone so that the red ring of light surrounds your face, and I thought, well, I can't really picture that it would be anything but centering it in front of your face. And it really did work. I had taken my pulse manually, and I had another health/stress kind of related app, and I did that, and then I used this, and it did work. What I want to try it on is, you know, if you're exercising, can you hold it there or put your phone kind of in front of your face and have it, you know, you'd have to start the app, but have it take your pulse at whatever point. I know sometimes when people are exercising and they stop, their pulse drops very quickly, so they don't have an idea of what their active pulse was. So this one's kind of fun to play with and to see where they'll go with it next.
There's a lot of health apps coming out. There's another one I saw yesterday mentioned on Twitter that will help you improve your hearing. And whether you believe that or not, it also will help you to test your hearing by playing different tones and different ranges, and it plays them on the left and then on the right, and there's sliders, and you adjust them down to where you can't, you know, you can just barely hear the tones, and it goes through various sequences, and then it can analyze it. It's actually pretty accessible with VoiceOver. The only problem is you have to hear the tone, and when you move the slider, of course, the tone gets quieter anyway to allow VoiceOver to speak, so then you have to wait till VoiceOver stops talking to see if you can still hear the tone. When I got through all of the testing, I clicked the button to show results, and it crashed the app with VoiceOver. So kind of a fail, but hopefully it's something they can update. It's free. And I guess where I'm headed with that is it's just kind of neat to see these sort of health-related apps coming to the iPhone. So that's kind of neat. It's kind of neat to see what these developers are are doing in the health space with the iOS and the iPhone devices.
Not only help, but with special education too, and augmentative communication, things are going with leaps and bounds. I know this summer I had different experiences where we were using iPads with kids who are deafblind, and we had kids that were playing with iPads that were 3 or 4 years old, and it was amazing to see what different apps we have for those kind of kids too.
Absolutely. Any other thoughts on that stuff before we jump to the next topic? I fear we may go, we are going to go over a little bit tonight. It's just about 9 o'clock, and there's a couple of non-iPhone topics I'd like to get in, and of course we have a lot more for you that we will hopefully get to, but may not, and if we don't, then we'll put those topics and their associated URLs on the show notes page so you can catch up on all the stuff we didn't get to. But any other thoughts on iPhone before I jump to the next thing? Amazon has a cloud music service. This isn't new. It's had a cloud music service, but now it has match capability, kind of like the iTunes Music Match that Apple launched. Amazon has something similar, except now you get 10 times as many tracks, I believe, and I've not used the match functionality here. I've used their cloud-based service for a while. There is an iOS app which is accessible. It makes me very happy. The Android app, last I tried it, was accessible, which is awesome. The thing on the Mac, the downloader, worked, although it could be better. And I'm not sure, in Windows it worked as well, but I'm not sure if there's player apps for that or not. Either way, I haven't tried the Match, and I'm wondering if anyone out there has tried it. You can get a free trial, if you want, off of Amazon's site, and it will attempt to, essentially what it attempts to do is to scan your music library, your existing library, and if Amazon has tracks that you have already in its library, it makes those available to you, and if it doesn't, then it will upload those tracks to its service, so that again, you have those available to you anywhere in the cloud. And that's how the Match concept sort of works in a nutshell. Has anyone used the Amazon Match?
I've not used either of them, iTunes Match or the Amazon service, but I definitely plan to check them both out. I think it's a great concept and a great way for storing a lot of music.
It's going to be interesting, especially if it's accessible.
I pay for iTunes Match, and I like it a lot. It works for me to manage my music pretty well. I have not, however, tried the Amazon Match feature.
Yeah, I've been using iTunes Match for a while, and I like it, but it's interesting to see the Amazon's, you get more space, or I should say not so much space, because it really counts the amount of tracks that you have available, regardless of how big they are. But with the Amazon one, you get more for, I believe, roughly the same price. It might even be a little less. But anyway, there is a link there if you want to check that out, and you can get a free trial of it. It'll be interesting. I'd love to hear from someone, find out how accessible the matching process is, either on Windows or the Mac, because obviously that's a big part of this whole thing, is the process by which you can get your existing music tracks matched and uploaded to the cloud. Let's see. Flexi. Flexi is an app that I believe we spoke about last week. If not, we could probably talk for an hour just by itself. Flexi, Flexy, is an app for the iPhone that is revolutionizing how people type. And it's really amazing. I think we did talk about this, but if not, maybe we can cover it more in depth next week. It is an amazing app. It's truly
fantastic.
That has...
It's
yeah,
fantastic.
It's a wonderful
It's
program,
impressed me right? more than any other app, I think, ever.
I really think, I mean, I've been able to type really fast using Flexi, you know, for emails and text messages. It's just really amazing technology. And from the first time that I saw a demo at the NFB convention, I was like, wow, this is cool.
I want to see it integrated into the actual keyboard.
I agree.
As we see the emoticons stuff integrated when you download that application, I think that we need to have the Flexi application in iPhone. And not just iPhone. I think that Flexi needs to make deals with Android and Microsoft to put it in there, because I think that it's important to have a accessible keyboard that allows you to type relatively quickly. You know, I'm like, I don't know what this Flexi is. I've heard about it. I don't want to try it right now. But I tried it, and I tried the free one when there was a free option, and I really liked it, and I decided to get it when it was like $4.99. So it was a really good purchase.
It has come down in price. I think it was like $14.99 or $15, something like that when I bought it. And then it was on sale, and they had a light version, and then it may even still be $4.99. I know it's considerably less than the $14.99 or whatever it was that I paid. Even so, totally worth it. I'm certainly not sad that I paid the higher price. It's a fantastic app. I use it way more than apps I've paid a lot more money for. And I do agree that it would be fantastic if the Flexi keyboard system could be worked into the rest of the OS and also could be made available on Android. Unfortunately, Flexi doesn't necessarily have that ability. Apple controls what keyboards are available, and it is those keyboards that Apple includes in its operating system. You can't install third-party keyboards and make them work as a default keyboard on Apple devices. So I only throw this out there because I see a lot of tweets from people who essentially are blaming Flexi for not making this available, and it's really not their ability or problem. They can't do that. Apple just doesn't allow that to happen. So hopefully they can strike up some sort of deal. I happen to know that Apple has $1 billion now flying around that they should invest in something worthwhile like this. And hopefully they will. And it would be wonderful if they would license this technology or whatever. Certainly it revolutionizes it. Just a quick sort of thumbnail sketch of what Flexi does. And I know we're already over time, so I've got to keep this brief. But basically what it is you can type on your screen. You don't have to look for keys or find them exactly. You just type the patterns of where you think those keys should be. Even if they're not there, Flexi sort of monitors how you are typing, the patterns that your fingers are making, and will then figure out or predict what word you are trying to type based on where you touch the screen. So you don't need to find actual keys on the touch screen. You can just sort of type on an imaginary keyboard, as it were, and it will sort of detect what you're doing. It's sort of magic. It's amazing.
It really is. And I think 99 times out of 100, it gets it right. I've seen a couple words where you have to swipe down to get the word you meant to type, but it's very accurate.
It's amazing. The reason we're mentioning them, though, this month is because they have an article that the blind and visually impaired are the fastest growing iPhone market. So take that, mainstream app developers. We are a market, and we're the fastest growing, and that just makes us awesome. So anyway, awesome information from Flexi, and we've got that URL as well available to you. It is great to see that we are being identified as a market and not just a problem. That's, I think, wonderful to see. So Google's self-driving cars. We've heard about these. Google has been working on them for a while, and they're now legal in California, although I think that just came down a couple days ago, so you'll hear about that next month. Anyway, they're self-driving autonomous automobiles completed over 300,000 miles without accident, and they're deemed safe for commuting. So that isn't to say that people will be commuting in them tomorrow, but 300,000 miles without a single accident, that's, you know, pretty darn good. That is better than most drivers. So what do people think? Actually, this will be interesting. I would be scared. I admit, I would be scared to own a Google self-driving car, but
I agree with you, Steve. I think there are too many factors. You know, technology.
There are too many unknown factors. There are way too many unknown factors. And with both the Google self-driving car and the NFB initiative, whatever it's called, I can't remember right now, there are just too many unknown factors. You know, we may have the ability to be able to drive them, but will we be able to do that within the next few years? I'm sort of doubting it, besides people who are higher up in Google maybe, but I really don't think it's going to come to the mainstream for a while to come.
Luke, any thoughts on self-driving cars?
I was surprised to see that the Google self-driving car was on the list. That was probably the biggest topic that caught my attention. I've also done some research in the past, about 2 years ago, that I've started my research with it, and I've gone along with the NFB car that they've been working on. Google's cars that they're using for the self-driving thing is took a big leap of going from the NFB, which is a physical driver doing the work, whereas you have a car that's... I thought that was amazing that they could do that, although I agree with everybody else that it's, again, not safe for the mainstream to use. There are too many unknown factors, and when you're thinking about it, this is a typical stereotype. Whenever a sighted person is factoring in stuff for the visually impaired, they don't really factor in everything that needs to be factored into the situation. Reason being, they take a lot of stuff that they do every day for granted and they don't realize it, whereas we, as the visually impaired, you know, hey, what if there's a car here when we're trying to park? If by some means, now this is just hypothetical, I'm not really sure how exactly it works, but say if you want to park somewhere and there is a car there, and the car that you're driving, or should I say the car is driving itself, wants to remember that location so that when you return to home or when you're going on your way to work, if there's a car in your spot and the car, the Google self-driving car, recognizes that space, what would it do? Would it take you back home? Would it have you go over a bridge? Would it have you go under the bridge? Where's it going to take you? That's a little concerning. Safety, and not only to you, but to everybody else. You know, is it going by satellites? If it's going on main roads, is it deciding to go through a field? There's so many bugs that I can't even fathom at this moment, and I probably won't be able to think of all the flaws or possibilities that could happen in the next couple months, and I'm sure it will eventually be something that will come into the mainstream, but I agree that it won't be for a long while, and once it does, then I'm still not sure if I would want to test it or not.
Definitely interesting insights there, and I totally agree. I'm amazed at the number. I mean, given all the variables involved and factors and things that can go wrong, I'm amazed that the thing has driven 300,000 miles without an accident on actual roads. That's kind of a staggering statistic. I don't know what went wrong or what didn't behave exactly the right way, but the fact that it did, I don't know many humans that have... I've driven 300,000 miles without an accident of some sort. You know, it's an impressive record, but I don't know. I just worry about all the variables as well. Then again, I've driven with people that have almost fallen asleep and things like that. I was on a bus one time and a driver almost fell asleep. And so, you know, I mean, there's variables there as well. It's hard to... There's no accounting for everything, but it'll be interesting to see what happens, especially... You know, if that's where we are today, where are we going to be in 10 years? Is everyone going to be driving one of these things? Will someday we listen to this podcast and think, oh my gosh, I can't believe this was done at a time when people actually drove cars. How, you know, old-fashioned is that? And speaking of futuristic stuff, will the elderly ever accept care from robots is another article we have this month talking about, of all things, whether or not the elderly might accept care from robotic help versus help of the human variety. We'll go ahead and put that up on the show notes page. We also have an article about screen readers that are the 10 affordable screen readers, and Verizon launching an accessibility app. Any thoughts on the Verizon launching an accessibility app?
As I stated before, I'm an AT&T customer, but I'm considering switching to Verizon. I don't know what this app is supposed to do, but I would be looking at it and seeing what it does. And I'm guessing you probably don't have to have a Verizon iPhone to be able to get the app. I don't know that for sure. You may have to, but it kind of just depends on what the application does. And so we'll have to see.
I was kind of wondering about that myself, what exactly it can do. I'm sure from being iPhone users, I'm just an iPod user myself. Going through the App Store and browsing through the new games and the new gadgets and what you can do with this app or what you can do with that app. I don't know if you're like me, and I have not much of a life where I can go through a bunch and see if it's accessible. Now, a bunch of these games that are on the App Store and that are probably in the top 25 category are more of a graphic-based type of game. And unfortunately, there's a lot of fun games on the App Store that I'm sure a lot of us would like to play, but, you know, it's just not accessible for us. High possibility of thinking is maybe, perhaps, that anybody associated with JAWS knows that the 13.0 has an OCR scanner built into it. Maybe the accessibility app that they're launching could possibly take the graphic or image or whatever the case is, a button, and if in the case of that the characters or words or phrase that the company has not encrypted into the button or the screen reader to, or in this case, the accessibility, the voiceover to read, maybe this accessibility app your scanner and perhaps take a graphical image and convert it into possibly a tab or a link format so that we can click on it. That's a bit far-fetched as far as a screen reader for, I apologize, not screen reader, voiceover can do for iPhone or iPod, but we'll see. I'm not quite sure what it does, but it's accessibility, so I'll take what I can get.
Accessibility rocks, and it is interesting, though, that they introduced this when there is so much mainstream accessibility now, not just in iOS devices, but Android as well. A lot of them have TalkBack and some of the other accessibility packages installed, or they can be installed, and making them accessible for free, virtually out of the box, if not out of the box, so that's exciting stuff. The other link that we have for you is reported by CNET, and it's about watching live TV on your phone. And I haven't read this story, but it'll be kind of a good teaser for those folks that have followed along with us to maybe check out. It's a CNET article talking about a way that you can do that. They say, watch live TV on your phone. No, really. So I think what they mean there is, really, check it out. It'll be in the show notes. I realize we've gone over yet again this evening, and I'd like to both apologize and thank everyone. I know that this is supposed to be an hour, and we have gone over that, but appreciate our panel for staying with us, and all of you for continuing to listen to the podcast, and hopefully you've enjoyed it. Thank you also for those who are contributing in the chat window. And again, our apologies about regarding the issues we've had sharing the links and so forth, but we'll make sure we have those in the show notes. So, Rich, thanks for joining us this evening.
No problem. It's been great. It's been a lot of fun. I want to thank Cerotech and Cerospectives for giving me this opportunity. And if anybody would like to contact me, I'd be glad to give my email, which is rich, R-I-C-H-C-A-V as in Victor, 1014 at gmail.com, or feel free to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/richcav, R-I-C-H-C-A-V is my Twitter name, and I'm a very active tweeter, but glad to correspond with everybody, and thank you, Cerotech, for the opportunity. It's been great.
Rich is an active tweeter, and I appreciate that. He tweeted a lot from the NFB convention this past year and met the developers of the aforementioned Flexi, and if it wasn't for
Absolutely,
his
it was fun.
Very positive tweets, I probably would have not bought the app, so it's your fault. But yes, it is the most awesome app ever, and I appreciate that. So thanks, Rich, so much.
No problem.
Luke, thanks so much for joining us this evening, and I don't know if you would like to share contact info as well, but if you would, go ahead.
Alrighty. Well, I appreciate being on the podcast tonight. I really appreciate the offer from Lisa from Cerotech. If you would like to, feel free to contact me in email. A couple things that I do is, along with podcasts and other stuff like that, I do radio business as well. I'm doing that for a career possibility. I also do weather, and if you are a weather geek like I am, I do have a group for Gmail if you're interested in forecast. I live in Pennsylvania, so of course I don't cover that much of a wide range as far as the meteorology goes. However, I can add you on our list. You can contact me at lwleiby@gmail.com.
All right, Luke, thanks very much for that. And what an awesome array of hobbies. I really like to see that. And of course, wish you much success with the radio endeavors and the recording engineering and all the other stuff you're into. That's exciting. And again, thanks for joining us as well. And Eston, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I want to thank Cerotech for inviting me to be on the podcast. If people would like to contact me, they're certainly free to do so. My Twitter account is at ESTINT, and they can contact me via email at estint1@me.com. And I responded to that pretty quickly. So if you contact me, I'd love to get in contact with you. Also, I do a podcast called Tips, Tricks, and Oops. It's on YouTube, and feel free to go and subscribe to that podcast. And we do different tips that we think are interesting, and we talk about different technologies that we're using. So hopefully you'll join us for that as well.
Well, great. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. I'm Steve Sawson. I am Steve of Maine on Twitter, which is silly because I'm not in Maine anymore, but I haven't changed it. Steve of M-A-I-N-E, if you want to follow me there. Or you can email me, and you're going to need to sharpen a new pen or keyboard for this one. Steve at S like Sam, A-W, C as in Charles, Z as in Zebra, Y as in Yellow, N as in November, Sawson.com. I think Twitter is easier, or I need to get a different last name. Lisa, I'm going to turn it over to you for any other wrap-up comments and to give other info about the chats and anything else that we should give for Serotech. But thanks, everyone, for joining me for this month in tech, and we'll look forward to seeing you for next month and for that month in tech. Lisa, over to you.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, everyone, for participating. Thanks to our guests. And to those of you in chat who kept things lively and interesting, that's great. Just want to remind you to check out the show notes for all the links mentioned here. And we hope that you will join us next month for another Serospectives. This month, we had the privilege of talking to students. Tentatively, we are hoping next month to talk to teachers. So just a slightly different angle there. If you are a member of the SAMNet community, or if you're eligible for a free trial, we invite you to join us there on chat. There's a tech chat room, and people hang out there and talk. It's kind of a fun, informative, free-for-all. And so if you would like to, you are more than welcome to join us. So thanks all for coming and for your great comments. And most of all, thanks for listening.